Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the culture we love that society sometimes makes us feel ashamed of. My name is Caroline, and do you have some kind of businesswoman special? Joining me is my own giant baby girl who smokes and says shit a lot. It's Richard Macon.
Hi, back brace girl.
Hi, back brace girl.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on to talk about one of the most formative movies of my entire life, personality, history, culture, religion, you know. Everything.
My heart is thumping out of my chest right now. My husband asked me before I left today whether I was nervous to come and do this because I'm a huge Sentimental Garbage fan.
Thanks.
And the answer is no, but I am sort of vibrating in that same way, spiritually and physically, that you do when you're like in the middle of a conversation or an argument and you realize you're not going to get to say everything you want to say.
Oh,
so I'm already
yeah.
panicked that I've got too much to give you.
If it helps, I frequently come onto this podcast with that energy.
Okay,
and
good.
I do think it's like, you know, you can't overplan a conversation. Do you know what I mean? Like,
no, exactly.
I can tell this movie means a lot to both of us. There's so much like the more I watch this, the more it's not like, yes, there's a lot there on screen, but I just keep digging tunnels underneath what's already there. I'm like, and this Simpsons director did it, and that I'll see, you know, okay.
Yeah.
Let's just begin at the very beginning. Romy and Michelle's high school reunion.
Yes.
Where, why, when, how did this movie touch you, move you?
Okay, so 1997 is when Romy and Michelle dropped.
Mm-hmm.
I was a 10-year-old provincial gay boy at that point. Kind of still am. And I definitely didn't watch this on the cinema. I don't think it even really aired in the UK, maybe. It was definitely a VHS experience for me. Possibly in a caravan somewhere in Wales. And to begin with, this obviously connected with me because we're here right now. But to begin with, my appreciation of Romy and Michelle's high school reunion was very much, I don't know, surface level because these were two beautiful women making funny noises and wearing bright colours. And then as I grew as a person, I'm already over-intellectualising this movie.
No, this is what we do here.
this is the jam. As I grew as a person, I sort of grew into my love and into my understanding of Romy and Michelle's high school reunion. Should we just call it Romy and Michelle from now on?
Yeah.
Because it's too long.
Smart. A smart editorial choice from you.
And yeah, it's just, it's probably the movie that I've watched the most. No, let's say that again. It's definitely the movie that I've watched the most out of any movie on planet Earth. I often describe it as it's the only movie that I can always watch and always willingly watch, including immediately after just watching it. So it's integral to my being, to my personhood.
Okay. No, I see. Here's what I love about doing this podcast is that, like, so Romy and Michelle, as we're calling it, because we're on first name basis with this movie, is a movie that is like a cult classic among people who really care about comedy.
Right.
Like, there's nobody out there who knows anything about comedy who will try and tell you this movie is bad. Like, only a very dumb person would tell you this movie is dumb.
Yeah.
But there are some people who appreciated it as the VHS cult classic Lisa Kudrow vehicle that it is. And there are some people who it is like, it is the Rosetta Stone for understanding who they are.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's when something becomes sentimental garbage. It's not the thing itself. It's how you feel about it.
So
is
true.
Embarrassingly, overwhelmingly, emphatically emotional. And that's what I love about doing this podcast.
I mean, I also feel sort of guilty and sort of imposter syndrome for being here because it is such a feminine movie about women made in a large part by women for women. And so I do kind of feel like an imposter as a gay man being here. But I think what's important to my appreciation of this movie is that, sort of, as you often cover on this podcast, it began as a guilty pleasure. It began as something that I was embarrassed to like because it was naff, you know. It was like it wasn't a blockbuster. It wasn't.
Did you go to a boys'
cinema.
School?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
But I went to a northern, state school.
Yeah, this is not a movie you're going to like.
I'm not going to tell have people. A t-shirt and on clothes day, am I?
Yeah.
But but as I sort of became more comfortable with my queerness, the conspicuous nature of my appreciation for this movie just grew and grew and grew, and I became less ashamed of loving this movie, to the point where now I'm a flaming gay and I'm a flaming Romeo and Michelle fan. And I guess we'll touch on that as we go along, and why that is and what it is about this movie that speaks to the ladies, the gaydies and the theydies. But it's grown with me and I've grown with it, if that makes sense.
It really makes sense. And I feel, you know, I'm not a gay man, but I certainly I think of myself as a real friend of friends of Dorothy, you know. When I was young, I found that there was this collection of movies and this was one of them. Another one would have been Death Becomes Her.
Oh, 100%.
Sort of vibrant VHS cult classics starring like improbably talented women.
Yeah.
But because of the patriarchy and patriarchal cinematic worldviews, these movies kind of got kicked under the VHS shelf, really, or into the bargain bin.
Yeah.
And they became, when I reached my early 20s, these huge tools with which me and gay men would bond.
Yeah, 100%. It also became a tool for me personally to bond with other gay men.
Yeah.
I didn't really know any gay men until, I don't know, my mid-20s. I was very much like a only gay in the village, literally. And it became something that, I'm sure you do this all the time, but, you know, you accidentally quote it to somebody.
Yeah.
Somebody says, I got this tie for £1. And you go, you paid a whole dollar for that? And suddenly you're best friends.
Yeah, yeah. And it's almost like, it's like a pop culture version of the hanky code.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh, 100%. 100%.
It's like, are you safe? Are we safe together?
It's a really good tool, isn't it? You can just drop those quotes at the beginning of any sort of touchy conversation and you know,
when you're in a situation like a work situation,
yes,
and you sort of like throw out an old businesswoman special just to see if anyone bites, and you're like, okay, well, we're simpatico on a base level. But this was my first and most important sleepover movie.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. Me and my best friend Mags, we rented this when we were 7 years old, and it was like we just obsessed with it, and we would repeat lines to each other that we didn't understand, like I'm the Mary and you're the Rhoda.
Yeah.
Like, we had no consensus of the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
It didn't matter.
It was, but because we understood what they were saying. And I think what's so important is that you get into that credit sequence and it's, everything is so bright, and it's almost the way they live, and they're just watching Pretty Woman, and like, it's so important that they're like, they're as obsessed with media as we are, kind of thing.
And this movie is to me what Pretty Woman is to
them. To
them,
yes.
And
nothing that makes me laugh so much makes me cry so much.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
I was, full disclosure, rewatching this movie on the way here on the train.
Good.
It takes me an hour and a half to get here. The movie is 91 minutes.
A tight 90.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Absolutely perfect. I was obviously laughing out loud. I was that guy many times on the train, laughing out loud. But also, I nearly cried a few times.
Like, I cry a lot watching this movie. Yeah.
I think, I just love them. I just love them. I love Romy and Michelle. And I'm so protective of them. And I think, in part, I'm protective of them because I sort of see what we were supposed to think about them. I see the way that this movie was pitched. It was pitched as, you know, female Dumb and Dumber, or like
female Wayne's World,
blonde Bill and Ted, you know, bimbo Bill and Ted. And they are so much more than that. They are so much smarter and so much more complicated and complex and full of love and full of, you know, they're so different from each other even that, I get so protective of them and I want people to know them the way that I know them.
Yeah, I really feel, yes. And like, it sort of breaks every rule of mainstream comedy that there is. Like, the point, like if we think of a Dumb and Dumber or a Bill and Ted or whatever, the point is that you get these like silly, schlubby, dumb characters who are often, like, if it's like a Dumb and Dumber, they're often like incredibly selfish, weird, misanthropic, fucked up people, and we're not supposed to, we enjoy them because they're funny, but we don't want to be them.
We don't learn from them
and you know, whatever. And then what was supposed to happen is that they go on a escapade of some kind and they learn in a way to be different and how to love, and there's generally a love interest, and then it all kind of gets wrapped up. And like, even the silliest, dumbest comedies need to have the spine of like a hero's journey going through it.
Right.
But this is a hero's journey in which the two characters learn that they don't need to change.
Yeah.
That like, actually they were perfect as they were.
And I think that as well, going back to the queerness of it, because this is, whether you like it or not, an incredibly queer movie. I don't know if they realised that in making it, but it is in a lot of ways. And I think, to me, yes, this is a movie about breaking free from your hometown in order to become the person that you are. It's also a movie about pretending to be something you're not to impress people that you already hate.
Yeah.
Which I know how to do. I've done it my whole life.
Yeah.
I've done it. That's what being a provincial gay in the 90s was all about. But, you know, it's also weirdly in a very... It's also a movie about people figuring out that the toolkit that you put together in order to survive high school is actually super valuable, not just in a... you know, relationship way, but also in like a commercially capitalistic viable way. They made dresses in order to survive high school, and then suddenly they've got a shop on Rodeo Drive or whatever. And I drank custard behind the newsagents to get through high school, and now I'm a chef. So these are the threads I think that tie me to this movie.
No, you're so right. And like, when I think of the things that like got me through school is like rewatching movies like this and Your Death Becomes Her and all these kind of like silly, strange, marginal but now classic movies. And now like so much of my life is just liking these things out loud for money.
Oh my God.
ain't life grand, you know?
You did it. You're Heather Mooney enjoying cigarettes her entire life and then realizing she can make a career out of it. Do we need to go through briefly what the plot even is for people who don't know this movie? Or
I find that very hard to believe.
Okay.
You're right.
Should we elevator pitch it?
Would you like to elevator pitch it? You seem like you're ready.
It sounds like I'm ready, doesn't it? Okay, so Romy and Michelle's high school reunion. On the purest surface level of understanding, is a movie about two lifelong best friends who are valley girls and who pretend to be successful inventors and businesswomen in order to impress their fellow alumni at their high school,
the 10-year
high school reunion in Tucson, Arizona. Which I only know how to pronounce because of this movie. Same went for Alan Cumming, apparently. Fun fact. He didn't know how to pronounce Tucson before he did this movie.
Good.
Ultimately, their big lie is revealed. But also in that revelation, they realised that they didn't need to do the big lie. They were good enough all along.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you talk about the sort of like queer allegory of this movie, I think there's... There's this thing where, like, so we open in on them and they're watching Pretty Women pretty women? They're watching, they're pretty women watching pretty women.
Yes, exactly.
In their like little matching twin beds in their like gorgeous, brightly colored apartment. And it really feels like you have pulled back the front of a dollhouse and you're like, and there's Romy and my doll and my Michelle doll. And here they are in their twin beds.
In a large part, thanks to David Merkin, the director, who did that incredible opening shot.
Yes.
That comes into Venice Beach over the sea, over the boardwalk and into their bedroom window. Have no idea how he did that.
Is it that song Perfect Day as well? Which I'm thinking of Legally Blonde,
aren't
I?
You're thinking of Legally Blonde. It's No Doubt.
Yes, it's No Doubt, Just a Girl. Yeah. Yes.
And he famously,
famous to you.
Famous to me. he got the rights to that song before No Doubt had dropped.
No.
And the studio went into it, but by the time, you know, they came to releasing the movie, or at least editing the movie, No Doubt had become huge.
Yeah.
And the studio were like, well, can we get more? Can we get more of their songs? And the director was like, no, these guys are the biggest band in the world right now. Do not even get in touch with them because they will strip our rights this song.
Because they've forgotten that they gave this to us. Wow, love that.
I know. And I love that as well. I noticed this on my latest watch as well, is that the music at the beginning of the movie is very 90s. It's very then. It's very like sort of present day. But the music in the middle of the movie, as they're sort of regressing and going
becomes
back
very
in time,
80s. Yeah.
In line with the mixtape that Michelle makes for the road trip. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, when they're, you know, let's fold scarves, and they've succeeded and they've come out the other end and they've got this boutique, it's this like super 90s dance track, this upbeat, almost even early noughties dance track.
Yes, yes.
And it's like present, past, future. They had to go back to see how far they had come.
Oh, and that was the podcast.
There's your soundbite.
Wow, that's beautiful. Very beautiful. That's so beautifully put. But like, what they love their lives, and it's so, and this the simplicity of their dialogue is just so delicious and yummy. And also, it's like, because I think lots of people fall in love with this movie when they're children, and it's not as ridiculous to you that the fact that their exchanges are things like, ugh, I hate throwing up in public. Oh, me too. Like, that sort of seems like kind of a genuine piece of dialogue when you're a 7-year-old. You're like, oh, I hate throwing up in public, because it's like so unbelievably stupidly obvious.
And I think it's so important that that's the line that people latch onto so often, because that's the... Do you know much about where Romy and Michelle came from?
Yes, but...
Because that's directly... So Romy and Michelle were two ancillary characters in a play.
Yeah, well, they started off as being an improv creation of The Groundlings.
Yes.
Where Lisa Kudrow and the writer of this movie, Robin Shift, first met as part of a troupe. They kind of emerged naturally during an exercise.
Yeah.
The exercise was so funny to people that, oh, me too, kind of thing. And people were just so, Robin Shift remembers being like, people were just so overjoyed to see these people in a way nothing I had created before.
Yeah.
And so they became this play.
Yeah, I mean, they were 7 minutes of the original version of this play, and they got a welcome applause every time they entered the stage, so immediately obvious that these were two, you know, these were the stars, really,
which is funny, because it's like we're living in it's like a great bimbo era at this point. It's like, this is a real emergence of the bimbo with the heart of gold, because we had Clueless like 2 years prior.
Yes.
And you know, who else am I thinking of as well?
Well, Heathers. Well, had happened. That was more 80s. But it was... Do you think that it was as fond of bimbos as we are now? Because...
This is a hard thing to say, because, like, it's... Because, again, you and I watched this movie as very young children.
Yeah.
It's hard to know what exactly they were originally pitching it as, in terms of like, who are we laughing at? Because I feel so firmly that I'm on their side. They're my friends and they're my Barbie dolls.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, this feels like if the like BFI were doing, you know, inspired by the Barbie movie, here's our retrospective of like Barbie-ish movies.
Yeah.
This feels like it would be in there, and so would like Legally Blonde and Slow Would Clueless. You know, they're very important movies of like showing someone that you don't have to, that like these beautiful characters who are silly and often vapid, but are so full of heart and who we're so on the side of, you know?
And are worth rooting for, nonetheless. And yeah, I think in part that conflict of interest or that confusion comes from the fact that, in my opinion, Robin Shift, the the writer, I think she was laughing with them.
Yeah.
And I wonder if the director, David Merkin, was laughing at them, because he's he's a Simpsons director, like you said.
Yeah.
Which is very much sort of laughing at the characters.
So I don't agree. Oh, we're going to fight.
Oh, I knew this was going to happen. This is why I was vibrating.
I'm a huge Simpsons fan. Mm-hmm. And I think that like a huge part of the reason why this movie works as well as it does is because it's David Merkin.
Okay.
I mean, obviously...
Same. No, I totally agree. I'm totally with you. But I guess maybe it was the studio that was laughing at them.
Yeah.
And that was definitely how it was sold to the general public. And like, have you seen the trailer for this movie? It's terrible.
Really? What's the
vibe? They just get it so wrong. It's exactly what we said. They pitch it as Dumb and Dumber, but
yeah,
with estrogen.
Yeah.
And it's just so wrong, because that's just totally not what it is.
Yeah.
They're so much smarter than that, and... I don't know. It's so much more sensitive than that kind of, you know, stupid buddy movie.
Yeah. And the real heart of it becomes so evident when they like, they get the invite to the 10-year reunion, mm-hmm. and they are like, oh, everyone's going to be so jealous of us. This is going to be great. And like, we didn't really enjoy ourselves back in high school, but we always had fun with each other.
Yeah.
Let's go back and like show them all what babes we are.
Yeah.
And then doing this questionnaire and realizing that maybe they haven't achieved or done as much as they had thought. And going back to this kind of queer allegory thing, watching it again last night, it really put me in mind of a conversation I had with a close friend recently who is queer, and who sort of said to me, they were like, sometimes I feel like, you know, I look around and like, what have I really done?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I'm... And this is a person who had like a very storied and very hard background.
Right.
And I couldn't believe they were saying this to me, because I was like, you've survived.
Yeah.
Like you survived everything that you've been through that is both does and doesn't have anything to do with your sexuality. And like, how could you not see what I, you know, how could you not see what I see, kind of thing. And it really does feel like this reassuring thing of like, surviving is enough. Getting out is enough. It doesn't really matter what you do once you get out.
Yeah.
Once you're not under the clash of like an oppressive small town mentality, where in Michelle's words, everyone look like they're going to a hoedown all the time.
Yes.
Like, that's like enough.
Yeah, exactly. And I think for many years, as everyone does, I played, who am I? Am I Romeo or am I Michelle?
Yeah.
And I think what's so gorgeous about this movie is that actually I'm both of them. You know, like inside you there are two wolves. One is called Romeo, one is called
Everyone
Michelle.
Talks like this.
And I say that because Romy's character is exactly what you described. It's that sort of self-doubt. It's that introspective, like, oh God, what are people going to think? Like, we've not done anything with our lives. Like, and Michelle, there's this gorgeous scene when they're filling out those questionnaires that you just mentioned, where, you know, Romy says, oh God, now that I look at this, I don't know how impressive our lives are. And Michelle, like, looks over at Romy's questionnaire as if to say, like, really? Like, is yours different from mine? Because mine looks great. And Michelle is this, like, sort of, as they call it, deludenoid, but in the most beautifully innocent, peaceful sort of...
Yeah.
I don't know, peaceful way. And I have both of those people inside me. And I love that moment in the tail end of the movie where Michelle finally steps up to Romy and says, well, do you think you can stop being such a baby?
Yeah.
And she says, you know, I've been chasing you around. I didn't even know my life wasn't that great until you told me it wasn't. Oh. I've been doing this for you. I've been trying to make this work for you. Turns out, I think we're great. I think we're awesome.
Yeah.
And that's sort of my own mantra. Do you think you can stop being such a baby to myself all the time? I have to keep that Romy in check, because, you know, there's nothing wrong with a bit of ambition to sort of take you out of high school, but just listen to Michelle sometimes. She's right.
Oh, it's so beautiful. And it is such a lovely, like a wonderful love song to the codependent friendship of like, I'm a real monogamist, and I've been that way with partners, romantic partners, but I've also always been that way with best friends. Like, I always have like incredibly intense marriages to my best friends, kind of thing. And this was very much how me and my best friend were. You know, we for definitely through primary school and for the first half of secondary school, it was kind of just us, you know, and we used to play Romy and Michelle like behind a tree in our primary school.
And then the dance moves.
Exactly. And it's, I feel like there's like a modern criticism of that kind of friendship or that kind of behavior, but like, there's really not enough appreciation for how much just one person can hold you for so long.
Yeah,
you know?
100%. And again, going back to the queer thing, like, that's kind of how I survived high school.
Yeah.
Like, I found my Michelle or my Romy.
Yeah, depending on the day.
Depending on the day.
Yeah.
Depending on which hat I was wearing. And, and she guided me through high school and I guided her through high school.
Yeah.
And we almost became the same person in a lot of ways. But, you know, you hold each other accountable.
Yeah.
The bit that I nearly cried at on the train just now coming in is that moment when they're at their prom, their senior prom.
One of the first of many flashbacks
of
Dream Sequence.
Many flashbacks. They are at the prom and Romy plucks up the courage to ask Billy Christensen to dance with her because it's the last night of school. And he says yes. And she's surprised because he's such a jock and he's so out of her league. And then he just doesn't come. He just doesn't come and dance. And they just, as she says, we just waited and waited. Yeah. And then, you know, she realizes he's not coming. Michelle says, do you want me to go and check if he's puking in the bathroom? And when she realizes that that's not happening.
Yeah.
And Michelle, oh God, I'm going to go.
No, I'm going to go as well.
And Michelle says, I'll dance with you, Romy. And the embrace that they do
on
the dance floor and the way that her head just flops into her friend's shoulder.
Yeah.
And it's so vulnerable. Ooh.
No, it's so, and it's like, it just breaks so many rules of like, a comedy this broad should not have a moment that emotional and that, it's so vulnerable.
Yeah, it really, and it's so early in the movie. It's like, it's like up. It's like, we shouldn't care about these people so much yet, but we do because we were those people. We were those.
Yeah.
And you know that bit at the end, sorry, I'm totally monopolizing this conversation.
No,
but
it's your conversation to be had.
That moment at the end where, you know, they have this resolution and people, they're wearing those beautiful outfits at the reunion and they've decided to go back in as themselves and they stick up for themselves and they get the
support. You're a bad person with an ugly heart.
We don't give a flying
fuck what you think.
And suddenly all of the other misfits from around the school come out and say, we really do like those outfits. And they needed that confidence. It's like the contagious nature of confidence and of standing up for yourselves. They come out and they support Romy and Michelle in that moment. And it's just beautiful.
It's
just so gorgeous. It's such a beautiful resolution. And, you know, so much of that wasn't supposed to be in there. The original screenplay, they just sort of, they didn't get their boutique at the end.
What happened in the original screenplay?
They just flew off in Sandy Frink's helicopter.
Right. Yeah.
If you haven't watched this movie, this sounds so wild. They just sort of fly off and there's no...
Yeah.
We're not really ever told what their value is. And although it is very much like a capitalistic value, they can run a business, you know.
That's false scarves.
It's beauty. It's beautiful. It's like they have worth and they realize it. And it's gorgeous. It's so nice.
It's so gorgeous and it's so funny.
Yeah.
Like,
can we talk about who your favorite non-Romy and Michelle character is in the movie? I think that's a good question.
Are you hosting this podcast?
Maybe.
It's good. You give me my maternity leave cover if that ever happens for me. I mean, come on. I mean, obviously, Janeane Garofalo. And it's like, watching her again last night, when you see Janeane Garofalo in a movie, it really puts you in the year. You're like, peak years.
Yes.
But I'm also like, she's so beautiful.
She's way more beautiful than she's cast as like the bitter, twisted troll.
Yeah.
She's gorgeous.
Stunning.
Her eyes are, I mean, they all are. Everyone in this movie is gorgeous.
People in movies in general are beautiful.
Right.
Right. But
she's and so what? She's got a monobrow that needs plucking. There's a Frida Kahlo beauty to that.
Yes.
She's a, and do you feel like you were her in high school?
Why do you say that?
I don't see you with that bite necessarily.
I think there's definitely a part of me. There's a fork in the road, mm-hmm. and it probably happened in about 2018, I mm-hmm. think, where there's a Michelle in me and there's a Jane Ann Garofalo in me.
Okay.
And with the starting of this podcast, I feel like there was a real chance that I was going to... Sorry, this is a bit meta. But the reason I started this podcast was because I had published my first book, the book called Promising Young Women. And in that book, I took sort of like romantic comedy tropes like Bridget Jones' Diary or like a Nick Hornby book or a Marion Keyes book. And I started off with this very like, my vision for this is it starts off in a very like traditional rom-com-y way. And then it kind of becomes dark and twisted. Mm-hmm. And then people started... reviewers and interviewers interpreted that as me parodying or critiquing romantic comedies because I sort of tried to subvert it, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I remember having this feeling of like, oh no, I'm not trying to do... I love these things. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, gothic literature is every bit as valid as romantic literature is and whatever. And then I started this podcast because I wanted to explore that. But there's a world in which I bought I bought the version of my own work that was being sold back to me, and I kept going down the like dark, twisted writer attempting to be the next Otessa Moshfegh and failing kind of thing, and I think that's the version where I, because through this podcast for me has been brain surgery. It's been the brain surgery that has made me more Michelle and less Jane Ann, and it's made me see that like. It's literally changed my whole life. Seeing the good in things that people think are trashy has made me look at my life so differently, because it's like literally hundreds of hours of sitting down and talking about liking stuff and what's good about it and what's positive and what's wholesome and influential. And it's turned me away from being a person I almost was.
Yeah, that's so nice to see that sort of... Yeah, you sort of ricocheted off Heather Mooney.
Yeah, and bounced right back into Michelle. Yeah,
exactly.
That's gorgeous. Thank you for asking me that, because I don't think I would have got there without you asking me.
You just did it now. You just did the therapy.
I did it. Thanks. Okay, so who's another one for you, a non-Romy and Michelle?
She's definitely not me. It's definitely not who I was, but I will always feel really protective and
Toby
over Toby Walters.
Yeah,
and just her. Okay, maybe she is me. I less so now, but as a teenager, I felt like, I don't know, I felt like I was always having to downplay or hide my enthusiasm for stuff, and in a very like British way, I had to learn to become like embarrassed of my enthusiasm. And it wasn't until I literally spent some time in California as like a early 20 something that I realized that like, oh wait, that's a cultural thing. Like, I am allowed to be like unashamedly enthusiastic about stuff that is stupid, about organizing stuff and about like
organizing stuff,
accidentally pissing people off and stuff like that. And so I do totally bond with Toby in that way.
Yeah.
And also, she just always gets told to fuck off, and then she gets to that point at the end of the movie where she's like, please Don't tell me to fuck off. It really hurts my feelings. And that
bit also makes me well up when I see it.
100%.
Because the thing is, it's like there are so many small characters in this movie, and all of them are granted this amazing pathos, even though they're all so silly and they're such caricatures of the people we remember from high school. Because like, everyone's memories of high school, particularly if they're, you know, the ages of these people in the movie and up.
Right.
Like, people do become blurry.
Yeah.
And because there's so much media about high school, I think there are probably girls I went to school with who are probably harmless that I have attached Regina George thoughts to.
Yeah.
Simply because of the fading of memory plus the influence of high school media.
And also the sort of blindness that we all had in high school to the fact that everybody was
miserable.
Everybody's life was being
made hell
by somebody.
And going through like a hormonal storm that like they would never be matched again in their life, you know?
Yeah. And I think, although, don't crucify me here, but I think that is one of the very, very few flaws with this movie, in the sense that like, through a 2023 lens, we never really get that redemption for the A group. We never really get that redemption for Christy Masters.
Some people do just suck, though.
Some people are just born evil. But, you know, there's a sort of weird disdain, for example, to, like, motherhood.
And it's a very, for sure.
90s feminism way of looking at, like, what it means to be a successful woman.
Yeah.
And the fact that, like, you know, they were happy to just settle down and have children, but Romy and Michelle obviously see that as regressive or whatever.
Yeah.
But, and I do hope their babies look like monkeys. But, you know, you're right. Like, so many of the people in this movie, no matter how big or small the role is, they're given this hero journey, this arc well thought out.
Even, sorry, what's the name of the character? Christy Masterson.
Masters.
Even she kind of, even though she is the only real villain of the piece, she has this kind of pathos moment of like, oh, did you become a news anchor like you wanted? And she goes, oh, what? No, I don't even have time to watch TV, since I became a mother. And I think it's such like, it's so broad and it's so funny and it could be in a sketch, but it's also this real wink into people who do exist and who like convince themselves that their dreams were never their dreams.
Right.
You know,
we all do that.
Yeah.
We all do that to an extent. Speaking of dreams, we have to talk about the 20 odd minute dream sequence that is just slap in the middle of this movie and does not do anything to the plot. It's completely just it's a purely psychological journey. And one of the things I realized on this latest watch that's so beautiful about the dream, because the dream is surreal and odd and fucked
and,
up.
And gets more surreal as it continues. It starts off being quite ordinary and it's like convincingly what happens, and then suddenly like
it sort of outs itself as
Michelle
being a dream.
Is topless and she just floats out the window of the limo.
After being hit by a limo and flying over the top of the limo. But the thing that's so beautiful about the dream sequence for me is that even though it's Michelle's dream and they've just had this falling out in, you know, moments ago in the car, in her dream, Romy gets what she wants as well.
Yeah.
Romy gets with Billy Christensen.
Yeah.
And they, you know, go off and get married and live a happy life and have children together. And yes, they're not friends at the end of it. But, you know, it just shows this sort of like indelible friendship that they have, where like even though they've fallen out and even though she's in a dream sequence, she's wanting the best for her best friend.
I know. So to get us back into the chronology, I think that's beautiful, and I do want to get into it. I just want to place this more in the movie of like they are driving to reunion. They have the post-its falling out, which...
Yeah, so they decide...
What I love about this, with no foreshadowing, there's no moment in the beginning of the movie where, like, Romy is looking at a post-it and like, huh. Like, there's no mention of the post-its beforehand. She just comes up with it.
Yeah.
And if this were a script going through any studio today, it would be like, we need just a button, just so we need some foreshadowing on that, just so it doesn't feel totally random.
Yeah.
But this movie is like, no, it's totally fucking random. They invented post-its.
I think maybe the closest we get to foreshadowing is the fact that she bumps into Heather Mooney, who is an inventor
at the
beginning of the movie, and she did invent a quick burning paper, which is kind of similar to a post-it.
So that's fun and psychological. That feels like very fun and natural and psychological in a kind of a zany way of like paper inventor post-its.
But
they don't
suggest that there's any psychological connection in that moment. It just sort of pops out of thin air. So Romy's idea to impress the
people
entire
high school
is that they should come up with something. They should pretend that they invented something that nobody knows.
And also, this is only triggered after they go into a deli to change into their suits. Ask for the businesswoman special off this random deli lady, and she's like, "What kind of business y'all in?"
And the silence, because they have nothing prepared.
Yeah.
It's that moment as well. I mean, you're very kind calling it a deli. It's like a roadside.
Yeah.
Every man in there looks like Matty Mason. It's like, it's incredible. And she's this beautiful, like, gnarled, like, aged diner lady.
What? A real Simpsons character.
Yeah.
You know?
Come again. What kind of business y'all in? It's that moment for me as well that reveals another queer through line, which is that essentially they're drag queens.
Yeah.
They're doing executive realness. They're doing business drag. And this whole...
And they're sort of teetering and they kind of move like drag queens. They're sort of clip-clopping around the place like...
And the whole movie, in a sense, is about passing, right? It's about like passing as successful, passing as beautiful, passing as femme. And in a sense, I read an interview with Robin Schiff, the writer, and she was saying, like, they're drag queens. The reason that they can get away with that scene at the beginning where they're like, can you believe how beautiful we look tonight?
Yeah.
Is because, they are beautiful, but they're also this, like, pantomime, exaggerated, like, 90s femme that is so performative but so gorgeous.
It's
nobody feels threatened by that. It's so you know, it's so big. And that continues throughout the whole movie, even to the end when they're in those gorgeous
those shiny plastic shiny blue dresses. And pink.
And you know the costume designer was the same costume designer as Clueless.
Oh, that makes total sense. Yeah.
All tied together. And I don't know if you ever saw this. There's the Starfleet logo on Romy's dress.
Oh, yes.
Because Mira Sorvino was a huge Star Trek fan. And the costume designer was like, well, this is supposed to be you in your like truest form. So let's make this a Star Trek dress. Isn't that gorgeous?
That's so gorgeous. And like, we haven't even talked about their styling that much, which is such an important part of I think why children love this movie and then why they go on to love it as adults is that like they look like people who drew pictures of what a pretty lady looks like when they were kids and because they've never had anything infiltrate their worldview because they're just this self-contained pod of two, they're a subculture of two people, they're just like their vision of what's beautiful or what's appropriate or what's feminine has never changed. It's stayed in the world of Barbie because they've never stopped playing Barbies, and they are one another's Barbie, you know?
That's so true. Down to like the continuity between what they're wearing on their bodies and their jewellery. Like that scene where they're in the laundromat doing the questionnaires and Romy has a beautiful like form-fitting very 90s top with like three of hearts on. And her earrings are a pair of dice.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's so Barbie. You're so right. It's
that satisfaction you feel when you look at a dollhouse and it's like, oh, and look, the books have real text in them and the lamp really works. It's like this detail thing that is just, even though they're sexy, it's just not for men, you know?
Oh, for sure. It's not for straight men.
No.
That's for sure.
No, yes.
But yeah, I mean, it was in a sense as well for me, I was living vicariously through them. Not that I was never not allowed to put on my mum's high heels. I had very, very open-minded parents in that sense. But like, I've never done drag, but I feel I feel like maybe this was my gateway drug to Drag Race. Like this was that. They were doing a really sort of amped up femininity. Yeah. And Mira Sorvino as well talks about how the inspiration for that voice that she does, which is kind of like part Valley Girl, part surfer boy, part like Midwest.
It's so...
So dislocated.
Yes, dislocated is the perfect word for it.
She was saying that like part of her inspiration for that was her sisters, her older sisters. And she grew up in New Jersey and they were, you know, trying... This was their drag impression of a Valley Girl in New Jersey. And she was trying to do that voice and she said... There was a sort of, when she read the script, there was a weird sort of masculinity to Romy that she tried to bring in through that sort of depth that she delivers everything with.
Oh, Ramon. Oh, Ramon. It's such a...
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
It's so unlike any other voice that you almost think that must be her real voice then, kind of thing. Main reason I know Mira Sorvino. And that and Mighty Aphrodite, which is a bad film she's very good in.
She won an Oscar for it.
She won an Oscar.
Like the year before this came out.
Yeah.
And well, no, maybe it was earlier than that. But she basically got this role because she won an Oscar. Because the original Romy was an actress called Christy Meller, I think she was, in the play.
Right. And Lisa Kudrow originated
and Lisa
Michelle.
Kudrow, yeah.
Yeah.
And she didn't, you know, Christy Meller obviously didn't make it to the movie, but Lisa Kudrow, in the time it took to develop this movie from play to screen, Lisa Kudrow went on to become Phoebe and to kill us all.
Yeah.
And become incredibly famous. And so obviously they, you know, she went on to be cast as Michelle, but they needed, I think the studio were afraid of having too many TV people in their movie.
Oh.
So they got Mira Sorvino, who had just won her Oscar for Mighty Aphrodite.
Wow.
And she was at the time dating Quentin Tarantino.
I know, and there's all these references in the movie.
Yeah, which is bonkers.
But this is a conversation that comes up a lot about this movie of like, if it were two men, there would be four movies and a Disneyland ride, right?
Why do you think there isn't for this? I mean,
Well, Mira Sorvino, her career, I mean, is wildly speculated to be this a very cut and shut case of this is someone who did not have sex with Harvey Weinstein and whose career basically fell into the doldrums as a result. I mean, I don't want to say that. She's probably like...
She's having her star is back on the rise.
Is it?
As we speak. Yeah, she's been in a few things recently and obviously she's an incredible actress. So.
But there's a temptation to say that someone's career went down the toilet. Like, she was probably doing incredible theatre somewhere that we don't know about, you know?
Right.
But like, we have a very narrow... But like, you know, in terms of mainstream success, we didn't see much of her for many years. Mm-hmm. Which is, it was so strange knowing that and then watching the... Oh, Ramon, scene again of the, I'm not going to have sex with you.
Oh, God, yeah. And she's in such a powerful position in that moment.
Yeah,
she is dictating exactly what happens. She is getting what she wants. She's using her sexuality and she's giving him nothing. Yeah. It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
But I mean, this movie was not a commercial success. It was...
It made a modest profit.
Modest profit. But I think on VHS, obviously, it did a lot better. And part of the issue is that it was R-rated because of all of the fuck yous from Heather Mooney.
Yeah.
All of the language was R-rated. And so a lot of people blame it on that. The fact that, you know, the teen girls who were supposed to keep this movie going...
And who did. Yeah.
They couldn't go and watch it at the cinema. They couldn't see it multiple times.
Yeah.
They would have had to go with their parents or whatever.
Gosh, I wonder what the different life would be for this movie if it was a PG-13 or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know if it's that simple because it is really fucking weird. It's not it's not Clueless. It's so much weirder than Clueless. And it's so much more... so much edgier and odder and like you said at the beginning of this conversation, it doesn't follow the structure.
Any rules.
It doesn't follow the rules that you're supposed to follow as a comedy. And I just don't know if it would have landed with sort of a mass audience in the way that like Clueless and Heathers did.
Yeah, because Clueless had that sort of like that ironclad structure of following the Emma plot and like almost having guaranteed column inches before it even came out.
Because of that,
such a like, it's, I mean, if anybody is out there and they have a good character and a good sort of like ear for dialogue and a sense of a scene or a setting, but they don't really have a plot, just serious. If there's no shame in it. Go through Shakespeare, go through Austen, because they're all tried and true and people feel good when they feel a classic structure descend upon them and no one should feel ashamed of that.
It's,
go do it, everyone.
It's that beautiful, satisfactory sort of feeling where you're
yes.
like, I know I know this story.
It's that Bridget Jones thing as well of like, structure, yummy structure. Because that was just a column, right?
Yeah, of course.
So back to that businesswoman special line. That was a moment for me where, you know how like the pause was just so long?
Yeah.
Of this woman's gnarled old diner waitress looking at them and them just like pausing and sort of just...
And you can almost hear Lisa Kudrow's neck bones creak as she turns and looks to Romy for the answer.
Lisa Kudrow is such an amazing actor, full stop. I think if I were to make a list of my favorite human beings on planet Earth, Lisa Kudrow would be on that list.
Yeah.
Like, it would be my family, my friends, and Lisa Kudrow. And Cher. Like, these are who I care about.
Yeah.
And I want to come back to the comeback in a minute because I assume you're a fan.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Good. But Lisa Kudrow is an amazing actor and you really see that amazingness when she has no lines, because she just has this way of like sort of fluttering to herself that's very subtle, and it's not that kind of very overblown Meryl Streep touching your mouth thing.
Yeah, of course. You can hear the cogs and she's not doing anything.
It's fabulous. But I feel like that was a moment when I was watching it back last night where I really felt the Simpsons DNA of it.
Ah, yeah, so true.
Because one of the reasons why Simpsons is as famous as it is, and I mean there's many reasons, but like that's as good as it is because it was one of the first heavily serialized sitcoms that did not have a laugh track. And when you have a laugh track in a TV show, you have a musicality to where the joke rises and breaks, and when the punchline comes, and then every time the laugh track comes, then we reset, new joke kind of thing, new build, new joke. But because The Simpsons didn't have a laugh track, it meant that there was more room for silences and jokes on top of jokes, and no real breaks or like formal musicality, just a kind of a sort of an abstract jazz of weird humor that, like, yes, there's a big joke for the big audience, but there's also a weird joke that's kind of a Planet of the Apes, but also kind of about The Godfather and kind of about nothing, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, that's, like, I'm just so... That form of writing and that form of humor has impacted me more than anything else on this earth, I think.
And the music cue in that moment is so important as well, because as they're leaving the toilet of this diner dressed in their executive realness, there's this sort of like, just to, like, to position them in geographically in the sticks, you know?
Yeah.
And as soon as that rug is pulled out from them and they realise they haven't thought this plan through and literally... this little diner lady has just, you know,
made the plot happen. She's unpinned the grenade, really.
The music just goes and just stops.
Yeah.
And then the silence just falls and you just know nothing could be the same. That's it. But there's a few of those moments throughout the movie where their plan sort of gets so far and then they realise, oh, this isn't going to work.
Yeah.
Like the whole, did you deduct £16 for your shoes? Where she's so... PO'd, as she says, that she can't lose enough weight to be impressive at this at this reunion. And then she says, you know what, we were never going to do this. This was never going to work. And then the next scene, they're sat on the floor of their apartment eating cookie dough out of the tube.
I still really want to go, though. Yeah.
Yeah, you're so right. It's that it doesn't patronize the viewer in sort of offering you these jokes on a platter. It just sort of lets you feel them.
Yeah, lets waves of them come over you in a way that feels like staccato and improvised. And I love as well that, like, and it's so what it's like when you're that close with somebody and that real road trip mentality of like, well, you've created a subculture of two between you where all ideas are good ideas and no ideas are bad ones, of like the post-it thing, which we as the audience are so in on their subculture and their world that we're like, ah, good job, girls. You've invented the post-it thing.
That's a great idea.
And then everyone they tell is like, excuse me?
It doesn't play out.
Yeah.
Even when
not with one person.
Yeah.
It doesn't work anywhere.
Nowhere. And like, even when the lie is being told perfectly, even before Heather Mooney comes and again is that little diner lady and pulls the rug out from under them in front of, you know, the most important people.
Yeah.
It's still not landing. The way that Romy delivers the lie to Christy Masters. Christy Masters is not impressed.
No.
She's like, okay. Oh, okay, you invented Post-its. And what?
But like, yeah, is it that nobody believes them and they're just being like, here is that weird girl from high school saying something weird again?
Or is it just a lack of respect for, like, as she calls it, ball-busting career women?
Oh, yes.
Because that's what she says to Lisa Luder, who is the editor at Vogue.
Yes.
Leaves the A group to become the editor at Vogue. And her sort of burn to her is like, you're just jealous. Because unlike some other ball-busting career
dried-up, ball-busting yes. career women I could mention,
we're all happily married.
Yeah.
And then she goes, yes, that's right, Christy. Keep telling yourself yeah. that. Which
I
is just the
that.
Most beautiful comeback, which I've tried to use in my life many times and it never lands.
I know, yeah, it's like, it's such an obvious and 90s thing to say, but that actor just sort of really delivers it.
I think that's the first time anyone said it ever.
Keep telling yourself, keep telling that. Yourself that. She's the inventor of keep telling yourself that.
Who, P.S.
Yeah.
Talk about this for serendipity. Elaine Hendricks, who plays yeah. Lisa Luder, followed me on Instagram
what?
Yesterday.
You are fucking joking me.
Nope. Can you believe that? She's a my Instagram presence is all about vegan food and she's yeah. a vegan, so it's not
at
completely
school night vegan.
At school night vegan. It's not completely, you know, unreasonable that that would happen. But yeah, yesterday.
Oh, did you message her?
Of course I did.
What did you say?
Of course I sent her a picture of my family and my pet. No, is it? No, I just told her what we were going to do today and
wow.
how bonkers this is that's
wow.
She didn't reply. It's fine.
That's
she's,
fine.
She's a
she
ball-busting, dried-up career woman.
She thinks your designs are interesting.
She's amazing. No, she's a huge, like, animal rights activist.
Oh,
and
shit. Okay.
Massive, very, very vocal sort of activist out there. Yeah.
Oh, I'm so jealous.
I know. She's great. She's fantastic. And she was also, before Romy and Michelle happened,
yeah.
she was in The Parent Trap as the
is
stepmom.
Is she Meredith?
Yes, she's Meredith.
Oh my God.
So yeah,
wow.
it's almost like she's ageless and kind of still is. She's still so beautiful. And Alan Cumming in an interview said something really gorgeous about her, which was never has a nicer person been so capable
yeah.
of playing a bigger bitch. It's just something about her face. It's just so perfect
yeah.
for playing a bitch.
Yeah.
But apparently she's just a wonderful human being
oh.
in all respects.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah, isn't that gorgeous?
What's her name again?
Lisa, Elaine Hendricks.
Elaine?
Lisa Luder.
Lisa Luder. Oh,
yeah.
I love that. And I feel like that's a character who, again, all of these people, they are, you know, outsized and they feel like they could all be SNL characters.
Mm-hmm.
But they also, the reality to them, there was always, in those bitchy group of girls, there was always one girl who was kind of nice and sort of shouldn't have been there, but was almost yeah. there by dint of having a perfect face.
Yes.
But had a more interesting thing going on in life.
And they almost didn't cast the woman that they chose. I can't remember her name for the life of me, but the person they chose for Christy Masters, the lead, yeah. the Regina George of the scenario, mm-hmm. they almost didn't cast her because she was not beautiful enough to be
yeah.
that girl. And Robin Schiff, the writer, was like, as a woman,
yeah.
I know that in school, it's not about that.
No.
It's about your, you know, big bitch energy.
Yeah.
You do not need to be the most yeah. beautiful woman to be the biggest bitch in school.
Yeah, so, or the most powerful.
Or the most powerful.
Yeah,
yeah exactly. So
that's
she
so
was
true.
Cast. And she's perfect. Down to the Christy Masters Christiansen. The way she says her own name is just fantastic. So beautiful.
So perfect.
I also wanted to, I mean, again, I keep going back to the queerness mm-hmm. of this movie.
Yes, that character feels very lesbian coded.
Yeah, as, you know, Lisa Luder's, you know, power, white power.
Mm.
Sorry, this is very broad city of me, but her white power suit that she wears. And also the fact that, I don't know, we could touch on this, but I don't know if it's necessarily canon, but the sort of asexual nature of their relationship and the poly nature of the relationship with them at the end
okay.
with Sandy Frick.
I've been saving this because I didn't want to get into the time after time of it all too soon.
Yeah, okay.
Because it's
am I splooging too early?
No, I think we've hit a good point now, actually.
Okay.
We've warmed up. There's been foreplay.
Yeah.
Because, like, I just, there's nothing in cinema I take more seriously than that time after time dance.
No. And also, how beautiful that the song they chose for that gorgeous reunion dance was the same song that Romy was stood up to at the prom. Ugh. And the way that Michelle and Sandy are supposed to be the two that are dancing, but she says, only if Romy can dance with us.
Yeah.
And she sort of drags that trio together in a sort of, I don't know, I do feel like we need to... Michelle is very complicated from a romantic perspective, because it seems like the only people she's attracted to are gay men.
Yeah.
Because the only person she talks about having a crush on is the guy from the drama group when they're, you know, they're looking through the yearbook at the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
She's like, I had the biggest crush on, I forget what his name is, but then it zooms. She's like, well, I wonder why he didn't like me. And then it zooms in on his face and YMCA comes on.
Yeah.
So she's clearly that girl that loves the gays. And also in her, you know, uniting with Alan Cumming, she still is getting with a gay man at the end.
It's so important. I think in the dream sequence, mm-hmm. and in the dream sequence, it's how it ends is that like they both ride off into the sunset with the men that they're, you know, quote unquote, supposed to be with.
Yeah.
Michelle with Sandy, mm-hmm. who's played by Alan Cumming, and who's had copious plastic surgery.
It looks like Christopher Walken.
Yeah. What's so weird is that the dream sequence is quite near to things that happen in reality. Like Alan Cumming
predicts, like, that he's very successful
and has a huge glow up. Michelle goes off with Sandy. Romy goes off with Billy. They both go off to have long marriages, and that's when you really know it's a dream sequence, and you're like, what? But it's what I think what's like really beautifully and like fantastically and surreally done by these two sequences, one of which is like they go off into the sunset with different men, mm-hmm. and one of which being like they go off into the sunset, the three of them, is that like the happy endings that are planned out for women, they don't allow for there to be people in your life who are closer to you than the men that you may love.
Oh my God.
You know? And like that would be a loss for Michelle. For her, for like, even if she got married a millionaire and was loved deeply, to not have Romy in her life, being her number one person, would still be a net loss, you know?
Think how much of like female romance culture is about, or at least female coming of age stories are about putting aside your childhood friendships and learning to be one person, learning to be a wife or a mother or whatever. And I think it takes pretty big balls in 1997 to say like, no, actually, the most important relationship in this scenario is this friendship.
Yeah.
Is this sisterhood.
Which
goes unchanged. In fact, comes out stronger at the end of the movie.
Which is funny as well, because before you came in, I did a session with Jess Pan on My Best Friend's Wedding, which came out the same year. Wonderful film.
Was it the same year?
Yeah, 97.
Get out.
And it's both movies end with, you don't need to have a monogamous relationship in your life. And I think now the trend is with these kind of messaging is like, I choose me and like, I choose myself. But these movies were very much like, life is full of community and intimacy that exists outside of sexuality.
Yeah,
and like
people, sure.
You know, both movies have the same moral, which is the most important person in your life does not have to be the person you're having sex with.
Yeah. And they, in a sense, they, in certain moments, they are driven by sex, but it always feels like a means to an end. It never feels like, or they are driven by romance, but it feels like, say, for instance, Romy's obsession, borderline obsession with Billy.
Yeah.
It feels like just an attempt to be treated like a human being.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like it's anything to do with wanting to be with him.
Yeah.
It's more like, I just want to get out of high school and survive.
Yeah.
I just want people to like me. You're so right. That it's so refreshing to have a movie that doesn't put romance over uber alles, you know?
I find those endings that are like, I choose myself, or like, fine to be alone, or whatever, I find them less inspiring, because I do think that, like, yes, obviously, fine to be alone, whatever. I find like this kind of move towards like these like hyper individualistic like pop culture or culture in general to be depressing.
Yeah.
Because there is no, like, we are all in definition to the people that we're around. And like, community is more important than like this fucking righteous desire to just be this lone hyper fucking success beast who's like constantly like 10xing on themselves.
Yeah.
Like, that's not what it's about. It's about pals.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. And it's so important that the grind that they ultimately do end up succeeding in is crucial, or has their relationship at the center of it. The store that they open at the end is called Romy and Michelle.
Yeah.
They're not selling clothes. They're selling their friendship to people. And that's, I think, why the movie was so successful as well. We got sold on their friendship.
Yeah.
We wanted to be a part of that. And we got to be. For all those years.
I can't believe that we got, like, out of Forrest Gump, a Bubba Gump chain, but we didn't get a Romy and Michelle's clothes shop.
Right. I know.
Imagine if, like a shop did, like, a pop-up of Romy and Michelle.
Oh,
it'd be so
don't.
Good.
Maybe that's coming, because it's definitely back in the zeitgeist
that,
right
that
now.
Style is everywhere now. That's kind of what is kind of referred to as dopamine dressing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they were dopamine dressing.
People are putting aside minimalism and monochrome. The colours are back.
And it's very post-pandemic, you know? And,
And speaking of Forrest Gump, the original play that they were in, Ladies' Room, which was... I don't know if we said this at the beginning, but it's basically about set in a Mexican restaurant, in the toilets of a Mexican restaurant. And it's all about what women say to each other when men aren't around in the ladies' room.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the play, apparently there's a man in the toilet of the ladies' room. I guess, I don't know the plot, but he's maybe with a woman in there or whatever.
Yeah.
Guess who played him in the original play?
No. Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks. The Tom Hanks. Isn't that bonkers? And Janine Garofalo, who plays Heather, Heather Mooney, played Romy. So it's all this weird.
Wow.
They've all done it.
I love that.
And Toni Collette nearly played Romy in the
movie.
Oh,
I wouldn't have hated that at all.
I wouldn't, but she couldn't get the accent. Apparently, that was the difficulty. She couldn't do the Valley Girl.
She would have just
believable.
Come off Muriel's Wedding as well.
Exactly right. Fresh off the
yeah.
Fresh off the movie.
Fresh off the movie, as they say. I feel like we skipped past Time After Time too quickly.
Okay, yeah, let's go back.
The choreography, I'm not a dancer or anyone who knows anything about dancing, but it's just so important that it's like, it's this weird mix of things that like, it's both crazy and childish and like how children dance at birthday parties.
Yeah. Oh my God.
While simultaneously being incredibly technically proficient. Like, you can tell that Mira Sorvino is a dancer. You
she
know?
Did ballet for like 7 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she shows it. And apparently the choreographer knew that and wanted to. And that's why it's this weird sort of Frankenstein hybrid of like interpretive dance that's very doable by
of just like wavy arms and like
and ballet. It's very balletic, but as well it's really like cumbersome and clumsy
and like kids who have rehearsed a dance and who are now doing it for you.
It's like a step away from like sliding across the floor on your knees.
It's really
close to that. And apparently they could not stop pissing themselves doing it. They had to do so many takes because they were pissing themselves laughing so much. just so funny. But it's this gorgeous, and I think so many movies close with a dance sequence like that. And you know, Napoleon Dynamite and whatever. But
Napoleon Dynamite, that dance sequence, I know people are obsessed with it, but it totally leaves me cold.
Oh, for sure. There's no emotion in it.
Yeah.
But this one, I guess, is a... I love that it's about their friendship, but, you know, and if you look at it having just, like, dropped in on the movie, you'd be like, who's that guy? Why is he there?
Yeah, because, like, they really have no relationship with him.
No.
But they, like, it's this weird thing of they just, like, have this incredibly codependent little subculture of the two of them, but they're like, just let him in. They're like, yeah.
Because they realised that he was a misfit too.
Yeah.
He was the same as them, even though they looked down on him.
Yeah.
I feel like that dance is almost their apology to him.
Oh, Richard!
I mean? It's almost like saying, yeah, you can sit with us.
Yeah.
That's okay. And it clearly means a lot to him. His face at the end when they're in that sort of like Thai statuesque position. And he's just, you know, he's got this gorgeous, relaxed, satisfied grin on his face. It's just gorgeous. It clearly means a lot to him.
Oh, yeah, because like Sandy is the person who did what they were pretending to do. Like he really is the most successful person, and he has all these houses. Like a great speech of like, oh yeah, you know, successful. If you house in Aspen, house
in Acapulco, Stafford 14.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, you know, it's such a silly lesson, but it's brought him nothing. You can tell,
right?
Except for this opportunity to possibly impress the people he went to school with, and it's like,
there's still one thing he doesn't have.
Yeah,
your own country. No, Michelle. Yeah, it's gorgeous, and I think there are a lot of people out there who begrudge him being so central to the closing scene and to their resolution.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and understandably, because it's sort of like, you know, it doesn't.
Yeah, who is he? Really?
Yeah,
and if it wasn't Alan Cumming, it wouldn't work.
This is exactly what I was going to say. Again, it loops right back to that whole Michelle being into gay guys thing.
Yeah.
And it's so unthreatening and atypical and queered. You know, it's so subversive because it is Alan Cumming, and because we know that he's kind of just playing along with it too.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't begrudge him being there. I love it.
But even if it was like, and I'm probably saying this because I was talking about my best friend's wedding earlier, if it was like a Rupert Everett, it wouldn't be the same. Like another openly queer actor.
Because he's hot, maybe?
Because he's hot and he's bulletproof, you know? And like there's something
so true,
so vulnerable about Alan Cumming's.
And Alan Cumming is hot in his way.
Don't
get me wrong.
Oh, not coming for Alan Cumming.
But it...
I'll come for Alan Cumming.
Oh God, don't say Cumming. But he's so non-threatening. I get why he's there. It's okay.
I think that's why it's so powerful, because it's so gentle, but it's so triumphant as a scene. You know?
Yes. Oh yeah.
Yeah, and it's such an incredible feat that this like death-defying leap that this movie makes, and you completely go along with, of like these two knockout blondes who are just incredible looking and like just legs and tits everywhere, that they would be outsiders or misfits, is such a nuts concept, but we totally buy it.
And we do have to touch on the fact that, you know, even in the flashbacks, Mira Sorvino's sold to us as the fat girl, and this film is very like 1997 in the sense that it is kind of fat phobic. There are literally four non-white characters in the whole movie, and they say,
"Well, I'm surprised that you counted four."
Nothing.
Yeah,
they're just used as the butt of a joke about not being able to understand English, which is
gross.
Oh
yes,
and
of course.
Obviously, you know, we see that differently now, but we do a lot of suspending our disbelief in this movie, because it's Lisa Kudrow and Mira Sorvino. Like they are. Insanely beautiful as teenagers with a back brace or not.
Yeah.
That's my all-time favorite line from Christy Masters when she's bullying them in school, and she comes over and goes, "Can I have the rest of this?" And she takes the whole hamburger.
It's so weird.
It's so passive aggressive.
No, it's aggressive. There's nothing passive about it.
It's full aggressive. But it's just, I just love that nobody does anything. Nobody moves.
Yeah.
And in fact, Michelle's response is like, wow, she can be really nice when she wants to be. She just doesn't see it.
I know.
She doesn't hear it.
I think this is where we air our bullying grievances now. This is the podcast. My Christy Masterson. I was in school, had my phone on the table. She was sitting next to me at like some, it was like some study period or whatever. Picks up a pencil, stabs her pencil through my phone screen. Through like my, it wasn't a Nokia 3210, it was more advanced than that, but it was like a Nokia vibe. And like, I remember just being like, speechless that it had just happened. It was like very much the burger scene of just like,
oh my God.
How can a human being just do this?
That's so violent.
It was so, and like, this is, it wasn't that she had like targeted me previously or anything. She was just like, I was somebody who meant nothing and didn't matter.
Right.
So therefore could just be kind of ambiently picked on. And I just freaked out. I was like, what the fuck? And like, she kind of walked away. She was like, it was a fucking old phone. And like, just like, walked away from me.
You don't get to decide how old my phone is.
You don't get to decide how old my phone is. And then I was like so incensed, and I was like, it boggled my brain. And I kind of went up to her later in the day when she was with her little crew, of being like, are you going to pay for my phone? Or like, what's good the deal? You. Yeah, but like her entire posse just sort of like looked at them, each other, and then me being like, why are you freaking out?
And like, oh, the made gaslighting.
Me feel mad.
Oh my God.
It's like, I had a fairly pleasant time at school generally, but like, that was one moment where I was like, I can't believe I'm in an 80s film.
Yeah. Oh God. It happens. Kids are fucking horrible.
Yeah, we were like 17. It's like our final year of school. This is like...
Yeah, I mean, I can believe it. It's horrible. I definitely wasn't bullied because I always had friends and I always sort of... I think I always knew my worth, which is your biggest power as a teenager, to just know what you're good at and why you matter. And I think I always knew that I had a sense of humour. I could always sort of, I could always laugh my way out of a situation or make other people, you know, my porcupine spines was comedy, as it is for so many people. But the biggest, most humiliating thing that happened to me in school was that we had... In a very sort of American way, even though this was in an English school, we did the vote thing where you vote for like who's the most attractive, who's got weirdly like who's got the best legs and stuff like that.
Oh yeah,
which was really crazy, creepy and odd, especially because
children. And it was managed by the adults who were teaching us.
We were 16. Yeah,
it was
horrible.
So weird. We had a similar thing. Fucking mad.
But one of the categories was coolest person.
Coolest
person.
Yeah,
and. A lot of people, it must have been a lot of people, it must have been a critical mass, agreed to vote for me as coolest person, ironically, because I definitely was not the coolest person. And I won and I got it. And
oh my God, Carrie.
I go up to, you know, to collect this award in front of the whole year. And I'm like, geez, did not see that coming. Oh my God, totally believing it. And people are like laughing and whatever. But here's the rub. I didn't hear it. I was just like, fuck yeah. I was
Michelle.
A deludenoid. Yeah. I did not care that it was a joke. I did not know until years later when, you know, a friend from high school was like, you realize that was a joke, right? And it was probably like 10 years later.
That's both a horrifying and wonderful story.
Yeah. I'm proud. Here's the self-love that I like to do. Is that I'm really proud of that guy for not being paranoid in that situation. Because so what? If that gave them some little moment of joy to laugh at me being sort of clueless and deluded. I was Michelle in that moment. I didn't care. I was having a great time.
I love that. And you. Beautiful.
Yeah. So I think delusion is a big theme of this movie and perhaps a big theme.
Delusion is the sincerest form of survival.
Yeah. It's maybe the most effective form of survival in that scenario.
Yeah.
I think we all need to get better at doing it again. At just, you know, saying to
That's
yourself.
That's true. And I think... I mean, not to be social media, but like, I think we have such a clear idea of how people are looking at us and why and for what now. It's harder to be deluded in a way now.
Yeah. I mean, social media is a fun topic right now because obviously this movie would not exist if Facebook existed.
No, that's so true.
Nobody would have gone to that reunion if Facebook is that reunion. And you get to, obviously online, you get to be kind of whoever you want to be. You get to put that, you have complete control over the curation of your image. You get to be the person who invented Post-its if you want to be.
You're the person who invented veganism.
Yeah, I do.
I'm the person
who
invented podcasts.
We have both been credited with those things.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's funny to, it's why this movie couldn't work now if it was set right now, because I know exactly how all of my classmates are doing. Or at least the ones that I care about. Mm. You know, I know how they're doing. I can just check on their Facebook or their Instagram.
I bet not great.
Let's not go there.
Let's not. We're all on our own paths. Yeah. The last thing I wanted to say, because we should wrap it up, is I really enjoyed, because I'm a huge comeback fan.
Oh yeah,
because
sure.
Lisa Kudrow is one of my favorite people on planet Earth. But so where would you rate your comeback?
I toyed with it because I wanted it to be an extension of the Romy and Michelle universe. I wanted more. Even with Friends, I only watched Friends over my sister's shoulder because I wanted more of Phoebe. And the same goes for The Comeback.
Yeah.
And I did enjoy it, but I'm definitely not a stan. I'm definitely not, you know, that
person.
Okay,
well, that'll be a different podcast then. But but there is something... The thing about The Comeback that I think that has kept people sort of really coming back to that well over and over again is that there is a real... beautiful melancholy to it, right. what is sort of sold as being quite a broad, almost Curb Your Enthusiasm style comedy. Mm-hmm. There's like it's a bit in the same way. It's clearly what Misa Kudrow is drawn to, in that same way that Romy Michelle has this kind of silly high octane antics and right. then these real moments of sincerity. Mm-hmm. But that character of Valerie Cherish,
yeah.
who is like this washed up sitcom actress who is doing this this show, has this whole background of being a teenager in a back brace. So it's like
this, I missed this.
Yes.
So she is Michelle, pretty
she
much.
She is Michelle, yeah. And there's this whole kind of sad sort of storyline that's kind of told in like laughing asides about how she was on the field hockey team, but she couldn't do anything because she was in a back brace and she just was sort of like there helping them and carrying drinks and stuff, and how they wouldn't let her be in the picture.
Oh.
And it's like horrifyingly sad.
Oh God.
But it's like as a Valerie Cherish stan, it's very lovely to see a different version of Valerie Cherish, but and everything's the same except she has a friend, you know?
Oh yeah, she gets the yeah. support that she needs.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's gorgeous. I'm the same as you. Lisa Kudrow is so important to me.
Yeah.
And I guess I try not to consume too much Lisa Kudrow material outside.
There's not
of,
that much to consume.
There's not a lot, so it's hard to do anyway.
Yeah.
But in terms of like face-to-face interviews, yeah. talk shows and stuff like that, because every time she does something that strays from
yeah.
her character mm-hmm. as Michelle, I feel really sad because yeah. I want that to be her. And
yeah.
I guess the fact that she originated that role. She did it. I mean, here's my favourite thing.
Okay.
The movie came out almost 10 years to the day after the play was first
aired. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so in a sense, the movie was the reunion
of the
10-year reunion.
Wow.
And so I see this as being, you know, Lisa Kudrow just carried on playing Michelle for the rest of her life. And
yeah, because Phoebe is really a version of Michelle.
Pretty much the same person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so interesting about what about writers and directors are inspired by Lisa Kudrow as being a human being who is like relentlessly sunny in the face of everything.
Terminally delightful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because that's the sort of the joke of Phoebe's character, is that she's had this incredibly upsetting background that we hear about in Dribs and Drabs,
yeah.
but refuses to be plowed by it, you know?
And she has this sort of edge that no one can quite put their finger on. And she's part of a subculture that no one really... In Friends, she's part of a subculture that none of the other characters sort of have access to.
Or many subcultures, it seems.
Yeah, yeah. She's just sort of welcome everywhere.
Yeah.
She can masquerade as anything.
Yeah.
And maybe that's because she had practice in that mini two-person subculture of Romy and Michelle's friendship.
Yeah. She's just a genius. She's the Meryl Streep of television.
She is. Oh, and Meryl Streep also loves Romy and Michelle. She is on paper as saying she's watched it 28 times.
Oh. That's nice.
Which is gorgeous.
I feel bad about that dig about Meryl I made earlier on.
No, she's good for a different reason.
Yeah.
And she knows she's good for a different reason.
She knows she's good. What was that acceptance speech that she gave once where she was like, even sometimes I think I'm overrated.
Yeah.
We've spoke so much, and this has been such a heartening and lovely conversation, and everything I wanted it to be.
Hour and a half.
is there anything that if we don't talk about, you're going to go away on the train back to Hastings and be like, fuck?
I want to talk just for one second.
Okay.
I just want to say one person's name, and it's Clarence, the brain dead redneck asshole. And I connected with him so much on this last viewing,
mm-hmm.
because he obviously comes across as an absolute dick, throwing his cigarette on the floor, making Heather Mooney sort of scrounge around for a light on the floor.
Uh-huh.
And his redemption arc is so beautiful because it's like he was just shy.
Yeah.
He was just the shy boy. And it's Justin Theroux. It's Justin. Imagine a world where Justin Theroux is the shy boy with a stammer and his cowboy hat. I just love that.
So bonkers.
So bonkers.
We've never figured out what to do with Justin Theroux as a society, have we?
I know what I'd do with Justin Theroux. No, we haven't. Nobody has.
Nobody has, yeah. Like, nobody I mean, has. He got two goes at Sex and the City. Very few people have that.
He was on Friends as well.
Yeah, and... Yeah.
And he married, or was he engaged to
Jennifer Aniston? No, I think they were engaged. Yeah, I'm not sure it ever...
I saw him once in the West Village in New York.
Ah.
Yeah. And my first response, rather than Justin Theroux, was like, brain dead redneck asshole.
Yes.
Yeah. There we go.
Beautiful. Richard, this has been a delight. An unmitigated delight. Thank you so much.
Oh my God. Thank you for having me. Oh, and I couldn't find my top.
Tell me about your books. This is your first book. Anything You Can Cook, I Can Cook Vegan.
Yes, this is my first book. It has nothing to do with what we've just talked about, but we connected via Instagram, and this is very much something that's grown out of my Instagram presence. But yeah, this is my first cookbook. It's called Anything You Can Cook, I Can Cook Vegan. And I will go out there to say it's the funniest vegan cookbook that that you will read. Maybe the funniest cookbook you'll ever read. It's just it's just stupid. It's just really stupid. And I think lots of cookbooks in general are very earnest. But it's very nostalgic. It's very personal. I've shot, styled, and made all of the food. And
what? You shot this all yourself?
Yeah, it's all me. It's all
me. My God. I cannot wait to cook something from this.
It's my
and read it just as a text.
It's my high school yearbook, essentially.
Oh, this is lovely. And I hope everyone, like, I eat meat and animal products, but I'm getting ready, as I said to you earlier, I'm getting ready to start phasing out meat out of my life. Not in a dramatic way, but in I don't need to eat as much of this as I am kind of
right,
way.
Right, sure.
And I'm really, and I think most of the time I buy meat because I have no ideas. Rather than because I have, any real fondness for it, which is silly, I just buy a packet of lardons because they make rice taste good,
Yeah, in the book, I call them it'll do recipes. We all have six to eight it'll do recipes that we just throw out there. And not that I'm trying to twist your arm into being a vegan, but really all you have to do is veganize those recipes and you can be a vegan because that's all we all just cook those recipes on repeat anyway. But yeah, this book is for everyone. It's not for vegans. In fact, I'd say it's not for vegans. It's for everyone. It's for people wanting to explore how to eat less meat, how to eat less animal products.
And it feels like if Romy and Michelle were going to make a vegan cookbook, it has all
Are you
that
trying
kind of,
to make me cry? Do
all
not
this
say
brightness
that.
And all this joy, and it just feels so accessible and like, oh my God, is you in a thing of corn here? Yeah. Is that you?
No. That's me. That's me.
Yeah, that's me. Anyway, everyone should buy it and follow you on Instagram because you're a delight.
Thanks, Caroline. Yeah. You're a delight.
Thanks, Richard.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.